Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So as we discussed last week, Catalyst Game Labs is teaming up with Valiant to produce a new game system based on the Valiant universe. And we were discussing how they were going to do this. I mean, if you look at Cortex Plus Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, they only made established characters, and all of the adventure modules they were going to produce were based on existing Marvel stories. Even the sample adventure in the basic rulebook was based on an existing story. What was that, Breakout?
Yeah.
Yep.
And
then the other one was Civil War, and they also released on PDF Annihilation.
Right, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lyle, but you have the Annihilation print book in your Amazon wish list just in the off chance that they somehow produce it again.
No, I ordered it.
Oh, you ordered it? Oh.
And it never came.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. I guess Amazon didn't get the memo. Because it was just, oh yeah, you can order this. It's going to be released on this day. And then I like, oh, why not? You know,
right.
All indications say they're not going to ship it, but I'll order it anyway. And yeah, that was last year.
Yeah. So I seriously doubt they're going to ship it. Which
closing
is a shame.
In on a year.
Yeah.
But no, at first I really kind of struggled to wrap my head around the fact that everything was going to be based on pre-existing storylines, because I think the three of us have discussed before kind of, why do you want to tell someone's story again? Because at that point, you might as well just like read a book or write a novel. But I kind of came around to it where it falls into that what if category, because it's not like...
Which was a popular series from Marvel. Mm-hmm. They may still have it.
Okay. But yeah, so just wondering if, you know, Valiant and Catalyst Games will take a similar approach. The article, you know, it was just a little blurb, seemed to imply that that's what they would do, at least for the quick start rules they were going to put out for free comic book day and free RPG day.
Right.
But because they said something about, you know, they will be from this storyline and the characters available to play for those quick starts will be, you know, from the appropriate storyline. But, I mean, there's no indication that they'll continue to do that. But after seeing Margaret Weis and Marvel Heroic do it, I think it is a viable option.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I've taken everybody's point.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's kind of interesting that it ties in with what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about playing existing characters, though it actually doesn't really count for me since I don't know anything about those characters. But
right.
Still, as a model, it works.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say because they haven't said that they are definitely going to do this.
Right.
I think what Marvel Heroic Roleplaying did was a very unusual in that the books themselves were released, sure there was the basic game which had Breakout in it, but then all of the other rollouts were going to be tied very closely to series. So there was a Civil War that was released in print, and then there was Annihilation, which was released in PDF, and then they had, for example, Civil War, you could get, like, the X-Men book of that.
Right.
So, it was really, really unusual, and I think Catalyst and Valiant will probably do something more in the lines of what you saw with DC Heroes or what you're seeing now with DC Universe.
Okay.
Will they release the core books and then have adventures perhaps tied to storylines separate from the core books? And like anything, if you're going to license it, they're probably going to encourage you to play the existing characters.
Right.
Whether or not, again, they go all in like Marvel Heroic Roleplaying did and say, hey, play these characters so we're not really going to spend too much time on character creation.
Right.
But with Valiant, I think they might have to do a little bit more on character creation just because people will be less familiar and they don't have the stable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That the publishers like Marvel and DC...
Yeah, that was something that Marvel really had going for it, is that even if you didn't know what the characters were, there was an enormous array of people to choose. So you could really do whatever you wanted. You didn't really have to make your own character because there's probably something that aligned with your idea.
Well, true, but then that could also be kind of daunting. I thought the character write-ups for Marvel were substantial enough where even if you were not a comic book person, as I am not, just from reading the, like, one-page, you know, kind of description of the character and what they're about, you got a pretty decent sense of who they were and how to play them. And, I mean, again, kind of gets into our episode of playing existing characters where, of course, unless you are intimately familiar with that character, then you're going to play them as you interpret them. But I don't know, having fewer characters available wouldn't necessarily be like a hindrance or a bad thing for for Valiant, because so long as they give a decent write-up of who the character is, and people would be able to play them just as well as the data files for Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
I think Chris's main point, though, is that when you have a selection of 5,000, 10,000, you're bound to find something that you like or something that fits your concept.
Right.
But I'm reading here, it looks like Valiant has a library of over 1,000, close to 2,000 characters.
Holy cow.
1,700, wow. Over 1,750 characters.
All right.
Well, wow, no, I know like seven.
I think since I looked it up last week, I know about six now. But
I think the reason Margaret Weiss did the established storylines the way they did it, it might have been part of the license. Because again, if you're going to use those characters, why would you not put them in the stories that people know? So it may have been a licensing thing, and Valiant and Catalyst Games may have a similar licensing agreement. Then again, they may not.
yeah, let's speculate on that.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of speculation. But in terms of the numbers of characters, I was more thinking of the, you know, myself and the analysis paralysis. Great, you have 1,700 characters to choose from. Oh, man, so many.
Be in one book.
Right, exactly. They would not be in one book. I realize that.
Here's my tome of characters.
Exactly. But,
oh, I broke the spine just opening it once.
And by that, I mean my spine.
Yeah, I am curious to see what they do, and as I said last time, I am curious to see what they do to the Q system to handle superheroes.
Ditto.
Well, we won't have to wait too much longer. Sorry, it'll come out in the middle of this month.
That's right, Free Comic Book Day.
Now, the core book will be available late summer. All right, well, this brings us to our latest campaign confessions, and this one is about Pathfinder.
Yeah.
Which we're...
Finally got around to playing.
Yeah, we're rather late to the Pathfinder bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
But we jumped on it and gave it a shot.
And then some people promptly fell off. Oh!
Hey-o. So those people not familiar with Campaign Confessions, we actually do two things. We discuss and review the system, and then we discuss and give our input on the actual game, and with the Pathfinder game, our game master was Chris. So the idea is Chris will give us some idea into the planning process, and then we'll give our feedback on what we liked and didn't like about the game.
Mm-hmm.
For those people unfamiliar with Pathfinder, it's often referred to as Dungeons & Dragons 3.75. And the reason is because when D&D went to 4th edition, their open licensing agreement was a bit stricter, I believe.
Mm.
And Paizo decided to stay with the D20 system that you could find in 3rd edition D&D 3.5 to accommodate those people that were unwilling to go over to Dungeons & Dragons 4E or unhappy with Dungeons & Dragons 4E.
Yeah, 3.5 still had a huge fan base when 4E came out, and there were a lot of people who just didn't want to move, so yeah, Paizo took advantage of that.
Well, I mean, you know, we're not talking about D&D 3.5 or 4E, but we kind
of... Well, we will be, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Talking a
exactly.
lot about 3.5.
Yeah, exactly.
We talk about Pathfinder.
That's what Pathfinder is. Anyway, but like we had kind of started our gaming group playing 3.5. And relatively quickly, just from the time we started, 4th edition came out and they were putting up previews. And yeah, you look at them and 4th edition was a radical change from what a lot of people were expecting for 3.5 or had were accustomed to. So like anything, when you roll out a new edition, there's going to be some resistance, you know.
I remember within our own group, because you and I, Wayne, had 3.5 books.
Right.
And we had played a we were playing, we're actually currently playing a game.
Right.
And then Chris joined our gaming group, and then he wanted to game master. So he said, oh, maybe, would you guys be willing to play D&D? And we're like, sure. And he's like, I want to do 4E. And I'm like, what? But we already have the books for 3.5.
Right.
He's like, oh, well, I want to do it. And so we decided to do 4E, and that was our first game as a group.
Yeah.
So we got it just when 4E came out. And I remember when Paizo made the announcement on their website, and people just went bananas. Like, they were really, really pleased that they made that announcement, that they were going to have a Pathfinder game.
The formation of our group kind of coincided with the release of D&D 4E. And I don't know, when I first picked up the book, I was expecting something very similar to D&D 3.5. And it wasn't, to the point where you, of course, are it's a new edition, so you have to relearn the game. But things were so very different that I can understand why a lot of people didn't switch over. And as Chris said, I can kind of understand why a lot of people wanted to stick with D&D 3.5. Because, you know, role-playing games don't really expire. You can continue to play them even though they're no longer supported.
Mm-hmm.
As has been discussed on numerous other podcasts, I think Wizards of the Coast kind of left themselves open to, you know, Paizo then taking a big chunk of their market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was reluctant to pick up Pathfinder at first just because I had the 3.5. So
yeah,
it was both clever of them, but it was a bit of a risk in that if you're going to produce a game that's almost the same.
Right.
And people were complaining about a new edition, and people complained about 3.5, even though it was an improvement over third, to say, okay, we're going to produce something that's not going to be a different game, but it's going to be ideally an improvement of the game. Mm-hmm. So they did that, and people responded very favorably to it. But yeah, it was after we got out of 4E that I finally got around to picking up Pathfinder, like really late.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people who are interested in my thoughts on 4E, because we're not going to spend too much time, you can listen to actually one of our very first episodes.
Right.
Was the campaign confessions on Dungeons and Dragons 4E.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris was the game master for that. So
yes. Comes full circle, huh?
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know. Is it a circle? Anyway.
So this episode will be entirely about the Pathfinder system, and the next episode will be about Chris's game, which I think people should tune in for. Gosh darn it. What do we say for Poshcat?
Listen to it.
Download. Stream.
Listen.
What are the kids doing these days with podcasts? So we'll divide this episode into character creation, play, such as the combat roles, and then finally the more intangibles, such as layout, art, and things like that.
Sounds good.
So as you could expect, the character creation system is very similar to Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, and you'll probably be hearing that a lot.
Yeah, who doesn't? Right? In fact, if you want to start the drinking game now, go for it.
Didn't think about that, yeah.
So yeah, character creation follows the kind of the same set of the same style that it did in 3.5. You choose your ability scores: strength, dexterity, constitution, wisdom, intelligence, charisma. Man, I've got those are burned into my memory so well for my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Then you choose your class, your race, and then you kit those out with skill choices and feats and spells if you have them and things like that. I suppose one of the differences between 3.5 and Pathfinder, if people are familiar with the older one, is that just Pathfinder has a lot more options. Kind of as 3.5 grew, then a lot of supplemental books were added on, prestige classes and things like that, alternate classes. And a lot of those have been included from the beginning with Pathfinder, though Pathfinder itself has also grown. So there's an enormous array of classes to choose, and feats. There's just way too many feats, in my opinion. But yeah, there's lots and lots of things to choose from.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's not exactly fair to, you know, compare the D&D 3.5 player's handbook to the Pathfinder book, because as you said, Chris, you know, Pathfinder could take a lot of the supplemental and bonus and add-on material that D&D 3.5 had or generated over the years, and could put it right up front in you know, the Pathfinder book, which we haven't mentioned yet, is kind of a combination of Player's Handbook and Dungeon Master's Guide.
Mm-hmm. And massive.
Yep, it's about as big as those two books put together. Right. So, yeah.
Well, the first thing that struck me about character creation with Pathfinder is that you are making characters that are a bit better, a bit more powerful than with Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. An example would be the dwarves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is common for a lot of the races, is that dwarves would get like a bonus to their constitution, but then they would get a negative to their charisma.
Right.
Now, that's a D&D dwarf. A Pathfinder dwarf gets his bonus to constitution, wisdom, and a negative to charisma.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they're still getting a surplus of benefits.
Right. Like, I think the stat array or the bonuses for race in D&D 3.5 were a net result of 0, plus 2, minus 2, where in Pathfinder it's plus 2, mm-hmm. it seems to be. Looks like the races also get a lot more special abilities as well. You know, the kind of, mechanical section for each race seems to be more substantial than for D&D 3.5.
Which I think is one of the strengths of Pathfinder is, I think you mentioned it a long while ago, Lyle, that you like games with levels because when you pass a level, you get a lot of stuff. And that's true from the very get-go with Pathfinder. You open this page in the race and it's just 2, 3, 4 pages of this stuff you get when you choose this guy. And it's so much fun to look through and imagine what you can do with all the stuff.
As Wayne said about the races, the classes themselves get more things every level.
Mm-hmm.
And when Chris is talking about every level you get something, they definitely make sure that you get something in Pathfinder. And to refer to Dungeons & Dragons, that's something, one of the corrections or changes that they made from 3rd edition to 3.5 is they wanted people to get more things every level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that people weren't tempted to multi-class or something. They could still feel rewarded by playing a single class. And I thought they did some pretty clever things with it, such as the fighter had things like a bravery, where bonuses to bravery, and you can imagine what that would do in the game. Also introducing a new idea of armor training.
Mm-hmm.
And by new idea, we mean new idea as far as the core books go. It might have been brought up in a supplement, and it's been brought into into the Pathfinder core book. And weapon training. So that's good. Again, they give you bonuses to your armor or to your weapons, and weapon training can also include classes of weapons. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. I might be wrong, but it looks like in the Pathfinder classes, there are no quote-unquote dead levels, meaning, as Lyle said, you get something every level, usually more than just a stat boost. It could be like an increased number of spells, an increase to a saving throw, but more often it is a pretty substantial bonus that's just in addition to the normal things you get when you gain a level. Because like ability score increases and feat selection are linked to your total level, but separate and additionally, you get bonuses based on your class level as well, and you kind of always get something. And I know that these dead levels were a complaint that many people had, and that's something that WotC is very cognizant of, or seems to be very cognizant of, when they're designing 5th edition.
Yeah, other than, as you would imagine, the sorcerer or the wizard classes, all the classes get something at every level, and the reason why the sorcerers and wizards don't is because they get new spells at every level.
Right, so everybody gets something.
Yeah. Hmm.
And nearly everybody gets something special, too, that is just for their class. Back in 3.5, a lot of different classes, they got special stuff, but it wasn't special special. An example is the fighter. The fighter was able to take more feats than any other class, so they could take lots of different kinds of fighting styles and things, and that would make them very specified, a very good fighter. But they didn't have anything special that was the fighter aside from getting extra feats.
And
but
weapon specialization.
In 3.5?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, really? I thought that was one of the feats.
I mean, it was, but the restriction was you have to be a fighter.
Not to, split hairs here, but I'm pretty sure some of the feats, as Lyle said, were fighter only, or you could take fighter bonus feats. So I think I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on the fact you said that fighters weren't special. You know, the thing they got was extra feats.
I liked the feat orgy that was the 3.5 fighter. But no, I do take Chris's point because it's also introduced the idea of things like armor training and weapon training, which, yeah, is a little bit special for the fighter.
Right, okay.
Whereas, with the exception of something like weapon specialization, the rest of the feats, or almost all of the other feats, were open to fighters. I'm sure there were like feats with race restrictions and things like that, but for the most part, the fighter was just able to draw from the same well more often, as opposed to having their separate well.
So they were one of the few classes that could also complete the different feat trees in a pretty quick amount of time, too. So, you know, you can kind of go down like the power attack tree or whatever. But anyway, getting back to Pathfinder, now almost all of the classes have something special that they go into. For example, the rogue has talents, the sorcerers get their bloodlines, barbarians get special powers with their rages instead of just rage powers, fighter with weapon and armor training. So there's more stuff, and I like that a lot because I like stuff. I find character building in Pathfinder to be really, really enjoyable, just because every page you turn, there's a lot more fun things to get.
Yeah, I was making my Pathfinder character the same time I was making my Rifts character, because I was going to join a Rifts game. And it's certainly a lot easier in Rifts. Yeah.
You know what? If you're going to use Rifts as a measuring stick, I think a lot of stuff is going to be easier than that.
No, exactly. I was just... But it does take a long time to build a character in Pathfinder.
Yeah, you know, as
it is still a little bit old school in that respect, in that, like, I'm about to join an Edge of the Empire game. And it actually took me a while to find time just to build that character. I'm playing a droid. But...
So you really were building the character. Ba-dum-bum-tsh.
Hey! As opposed to birthing it. Wait, what?
Right, right.
Oh, man. But, no, I think this is... Maybe when I started trying to build a Rifts character again, and I used to... I played a few Palladium games in my day, and it didn't seem to be as taxing as it does now. Maybe just because I'm older and you have a lot less time. But the Rifts was a really unpleasant experience. I'm not here bagging the Rifts rules. It was just like, it just took too long and there's too much flipping in the book. And Pathfinder was better, but it still took a while. And then Edge of the Empire, I was like, is this going to take as long as the Pathfinder character? Yeah. And it was quicker.
I really missed one thing of 4E is in having that nice computerized character builder program. And there are character builders for Pathfinder, but none that are as cool as the 4E online builder was.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I remember when I was younger, you know, crunching all those stats together, I remember having a lot of fun with it, but to be honest, the math just doesn't strike me as enjoyable anymore.
Well, you know, like building a Pathfinder character was fun up until it wasn't. So
I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
Kind of in the same boat.
No, what do you mean? What do you mean?
No, I mean, like, it was fun at first, and then maybe it was just the amount of time it took where it started to feel like work. And I guess a little bit of that is due to the organization of the book, which will come up later. But, yeah, I don't know. And maybe this is just me, but I play other games, especially like Netrunner, that scratch that intricate Lego-esque intricate building aspect of games. So I don't necessarily need it in a role-playing game, and I'm not saying that building a character in Pathfinder was this, you know, monumental task that I couldn't finish, but it got to be a little bit tedious of juggling all these things and just putting them together. Because on the one hand, you're trying to build a flavorful character, but you also want it to be effective.
No, I understand. I had it in my notebook, and you know, you do pages and you redo it, and you do another page and a page and a page.
Right.
And for the uninitiated, the process would go something like, you have your concept, you do your concept, that's all in your head.
Right.
Then you pick a class that matches it in a race, and then we prefer the point buy for the abilities.
Yes.
So you know, you do the math there and try to get the strength where you want it and the intelligence. What is a point buy? So you got to fiddle around with that. And we started at 6th level, I believe.
Yes.
Which was great because it allowed us to use the multi-classing rules that D&D 3rd edition introduced. And it was great to see Pathfinder continuing on with that, so I took advantage of that. So I had two classes to work from. Then you choose feats, and then you have like kind of your wish list of feats. It's almost like, you know, your Amazon wish list, you know.
Right.
Which ones do I want? But I only got this many slots. So I don't know if you're like me. You do your wish list, and you do, here's the ones I definitely got to take. And then you got about one or two slots you got to fill, and about six feats to fill it with. So you gotta, I'll come back to that. Then you do your skills. Then if you got like a magical character, you got to pick your spells.
Right.
Then there's equipment. And if you're, you know, you got your budget to buy those, we could buy magic items as well, or build those. So yeah, it does take a while.
Yeah, because if you're like me, like each step of the process from, you know, the concept and then picking a class and then a race and then your feats and skills and stuff like that, each time you might see something that will cause you to go back and adjust previous steps. Where if you're like, oh, okay, wow, if I take this option for a paladin, then my, you know, wisdom needs to be at a certain level. And, oh, hey, now I'm picking feats, and, oh, that feat looks really awesome. I need to go back and redistribute some numbers to make this work. So it isn't always the case where you have to go back and readjust things after every step, but that is a possibility.
Yeah, feats are what killed me, though. There's just so many to choose from. Just looking at the online thing, there's almost 1,500 feats available for the whole system. And I just spoiled for choice. I kind of get analysis paralysis when I got there.
Yeah, that too.
But also I kind of approach, one of the things I really like about this style of character creation more than in a point by system is that you can approach it without a high concept. I like to just go in and fool around with some ability scores and then just kind of build what grows out of those numbers. So yeah, I have fun with randomizing characters, but
yeah, I think you and I design or can design characters in a similar way, Chris, where I think both of us said occasionally it can be a mechanic or you know, the way two feats or two mechanics of the game interact that spark a character concept for us.
Or in this case for you, just a picture, huh?
In this case, I was kind of drawing a blank, so it was just a picture. But that's not to say I can't go into a game with a fictional concept first and then build a character around that. But yeah, in this one, that's kind of how I started. I just kind of like, you know, poured through feats and looked for things that looked interesting and kind of built from there. But I don't know. Probably, maybe one of my problems is doing it on an actual character sheet may have helped, where just like Lyle, I kind of started it with notes because things are going to change. But then I never transferred it over to a regular character sheet.
So how did it play? Like, now that we've made these characters, so a little bit long for us old guys, a little bit more of the same in the fact that it was a 3.5.
Right.
But you get more. And it's funny, like you might complain about power gaming and that, but when the game gives you more, you're like, oh, I'll take that. I'm happy with that. Yeah. And it's sad to say, but I'd be reluctant to build a character in 3.5 because I'd be like, oh, he feels so weak now.
So. I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. As far as the actual play went, I don't know. You know, actually, I think I am too old for this game now. It overwhelmed me. There was too much information and too much just stats and rules for me to get a hold of. I didn't have the time to learn the system as well as I should have to run it, and that hurt me. I mean, thankfully, Wayne and one of the other players who couldn't join us tonight, Yujiro, they both knew the system far better, and so they helped out with the rules immeasurably. Of course, you as well, Lau.
How'd you like that bone there, Lau?
Well, actually, yeah.
It was
primarily Yuji. He helped out so much. But, I don't want to get down on the game for it, because I was able to handle 3.5 well enough back when I was in high school. But, it was too much for me now.
Well, and again, just to clarify, you were the GM. So yes. You were keeping track of both the rules and the story. So I don't feel I knew the system better. All I had to do was focus on my character. And so when you were doing something with someone else, or, you know, when you were, there was kind of like a lull because someone was taking their turn, I could look something up in the book because I had less to deal with as a player than you did as the GM.
On the other side of it, though, I mean, that part of it, the system being that large, that's a really big positive for it, in that the just looking through the book, or I actually use the SRD online more than I did the book, there's so much there. It's just the world feels so full and rich. Anything you have any kind of idea from, you just type it into the SRD, and there's rules there. And one of the other nice things about it as a GM is that everything has an answer. You know, if you want to ask, you know, how much does an office chair weigh and how many gold pieces does it cost? It's there. You can go look it up.
What kind of game are we playing?
Office chair. Yeah, right. Well,
it's
I'm actually
Home Depot.
The SRD is in front of me right now, and I see the link for furniture on there. And for some reason, office chair was the first one to come to my mind.
I mean, a lot of it is just D20. So you're rolling a D20 to see if you can hit, and you're adding bonuses. Then you've got. Yeah, other than that, everything, you know, you got your skills and things like that. I played a rogue wizard, so I had a lot of, like, skills, sure, but I also had some spells, and yeah, they were difficult to keep track of because the spells aren't as standardized, and maybe it was because the last similar game we played was 4E, so where they really tried to standardize all of the spells and abilities, and we complained that it went too far in that regard. But in this case, and in all fairness to the game, we didn't print out the spells or put them on little cards, which is what you should do, and definitely we would highly recommend that if you play a magic user, is you get your spell cards. You don't necessarily need to buy them. You can photocopy them, just cut them out, but just have little cards and then lay them out in front of you. If you're playing online, have it on your computer desk. If you're playing it with your friends at some friend's house, lay it out on the table. Mm-hmm. It'll make your life so much easier. There's just a lot of flipping in the book.
Yes.
And it's part because of the amount of options and complexity of the game, but it was also part of that we didn't prepare adequately, and I don't think anybody did.
No.
People relied on, like Chris was saying, yeah, the SRD and hitting in and using the search engine there, and then I relied on the book.
Yep, as did I.
Yeah, so we just flip. Yeah.
Yep, I kind of sat there with the book in my lap. But no, that's a very good point. I did not play, well, I guess I technically did play a magic user because I played a paladin, and I had access to a couple spells which, in all honesty, didn't excite me, and I never once used them. But the paladin does have a lot of inherent abilities, you know, with channel positive energy, mercy, lay on hands, divine grace, might evil, all that stuff. And I kind of made myself a cheat sheet where especially smite evil, that's an ability that changes your two hit and damage numbers based on a lot of factors, including your wisdom score bonus and your level and all this other stuff. And so I kind of made myself a cheat sheet and said, when I use this power, this is what my attack bonus is. This is how much extra damage I will do. This is what the bump to my armor class is. And that made it a lot helpful because I didn't have to recalculate it every single time I used that ability. I could just say, it's this and this. So not the same as spells, because there's obviously a lot more text in terms of the effect of what the spells will do. But I definitely agree with you, Lyle, that I think many types of characters or many character classes would benefit from making yourself up some, not necessarily power cards, but something similar, so that you aren't constantly having to flip through the book or doing math on your fingers to figure stuff out.
Yeah, as far as like the gameplay, for in combat, we were doing a lot with counting squares.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe it's just my memory or my bad memory, but it seems like we were counting squares a little bit less than we were when we're playing D&D 4E, but we were still counting them.
Right.
Yeah, the
Pathfinder... sorry, go on.
No, please, by all means.
Pathfinder introduces this idea of the combat maneuver bonus and combat maneuver defense, which, when I was making my character, seemed kind of annoying, even though it's not that difficult to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But when it did come to the game, it was actually really helpful, and this is something to handle things like grappling and things that aren't just straight, like hitting with your sword and then
other stuff ubiquitously.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Hmm. Yeah,
I appreciated that. Again, just like you, Lyle, when I was putting it together, I'm like, this seems like it's pretty much exactly the same as my armor class, so why do I need it? But, instead of having to go look up the grapple rules and doing all kinds of other funky stuff, all the combat maneuvers are just, hey, you use your combat maneuver bonus, and if you get a defense, you know, because someone's doing a combat maneuver on you, hey, use your combat maneuver defense. So, I liked that.
I found it so helpful that I took the feat that gives you a bonus to it when I leveled up. So I did like it because it you know, I have said in the past that rules don't create role-playing, but sometimes when you have a rule like this where it's easy to do other stuff, then you will do more stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So
it's always been my philosophy that that rules support expansion of story. But I don't know, I found combat...
Well, other stuff is not really story, but...
I don't know, like jumping on top of a dragon's wings and stuff.
Oh, that worked out well for me.
No, not at all. But you did it. No, like, I don't know. It felt a lot better than 4E for me in the combat. We used Roll20, the online gaming board, which is highly recommended. I think it's great for anybody else who wants to try it out for online gaming. And yeah, I didn't mind the counting squares. I think combat went pretty smoothly. In some cases, it lasted a little bit long when there were some of the larger hit point totals, but not to the point where I actually got tired of any of the combats.
Fair enough. Coming from, for me, Dungeon World, the game closest to, I guess, at least in tone and genre to this, at first, not that I hated counting squares and initiative and, you know, the roll to hit and all that. I had just kind of forgotten what games like that were like. Not that I had trouble adjusting, but it did take a shift in mindset to, oh yeah, okay, that's the type of game we're playing where it is a little bit like a miniatures board game. Like, okay, count your squares to move, you know, roll your attack to hit. Maybe do something else, then wait while the other people take their turns. And I've said this before, I think games can either be very loose and allow the GM and the players to kind of figure out what happens based on kind of loose guidelines, or they can go the other way and try to provide rules for as many edge cases as they can. And Pathfinder goes towards that rule heavy one, which on the one hand is great because no matter where you go, no matter what GM you have, the game is going to play in a very similar fashion. But where you... We had this discussion with 4E, and again, not to bring it up. So I did not find the rules restrictive, but the fact that there were these very set-in-stone rules for some things, I don't know, not that they didn't make me want to do things, but I don't know, especially the movement thing. I was very aware of how far I could move. And the answer was not whatever is dramatically or cinematically appropriate.
The answer is 6 squares.
Right.
Or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's a case of the more you become familiar with the system, and in all fairness to the system, we hadn't played for years. I mean,
yes,
how many years ago did we play 4E?
Yeah, a lot. Huh?
And we moved on to like White Wolf, and we're fans of that. The Q system, Cosmic Patrol, which is very open-ended.
Freestyle, heroic
role-playing. Yep. Wayne's a big fan of Apocalypse World.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Savage World. So we tried a lot of different things, and none of them as rules-heavy as a Pathfinder. So, but with those games, I mean, people play them over and over and over, and they become more and more familiar with the system. And
right.
Yeah, like you said, because it is standardized, and they become familiar with how they can do things, which is going to make them try to figure out how to do something else using within the rules. So, yeah, I think it's a little intimidating for a new person, but I'm sure they'd find enough people around at the table to go, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That they'd be able to eventually figure out what they can do.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because it sounds like I'm bagging on the system where
you know, when I really sat down and thought about my experience playing Pathfinder and how long some of the combat took, especially compared to some of the other games we'd played more recently, a lot of that was on both my and our shoulders because we did not... It was our first time playing Pathfinder, and kind of we... I had kind of forgotten a lot of the rules for 3.5 and had to relearn them. So a lot of the lag, for lack of a better term, was due to me not being as familiar with the system as I needed it to be to make things run smoothly.
Yeah, a part of that too was also me being the game master didn't know the system all that well either. There was a lot of the combats I don't think were very well balanced, especially with Yujiro's character. He built a very good character, and he had a lot of spells that were able to shut down a lot of the enemies to the point where I think during the final fight there was one boss-ish kind of a monster there, and that it just didn't do anything. He just locked it in place, and other people went and just hacked it apart.
The second last fight?
Second last fight, yes, sorry.
Yep. Yep. Okay, well, yeah, no, fair enough. I think if there was one thing that I would like to see improvement on, although I think there has been some standardization, is just the spells.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, there's just some things that people don't really need anymore. And I know, yeah, you put stuff into it, you can always ignore it. But for people who are unfamiliar with a D&D or a Pathfinder spell, you've got your school, which you don't kind of don't need during play.
Right.
The level, you've already decided that before. But then there's the casting time,
mm-hmm.
which can change. It's fairly standard for most spells. Then there's the components, which honestly, I almost always ignore. I don't recall ever really caring. But if you wanted to be a stickler, there is that. Then there's the range, which... It does change. I mean, there's personal 10 feet. This is all on one page. Personal, touch, 10 feet, medium, so 100 feet plus 10 feet for level, and another spell's range is close, 25 feet plus 5 feet per two levels.
Right.
So, something that you would need to look up. Then you've got targets, who it can target, and that changes a lot. And then you've got duration. So on this one page, one minute per level, 10 minutes per level, one round a level. Another one was run round a level, so. And permanent until discharged.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of variation, and I know when we got to 4E, we did really chafe at the spells. We're like, well, what about the utility spells? You know, mm-hmm. I want to use those. Those are the most fun to play. And I think there's a happy medium between just completely standardizing everything so everything is the same and what's in a game like Pathfinder where it's very purist in a sense. And it's like, I think games have kind of evolved to the point where it shouldn't be that specialized or complex or fiddly. I'm not sure what the word is I want to use here.
Yeah.
But you're like, well, you have to ask the same questions. Like, oh, so sorry, how long does that last for?
Yeah.
What's the range? Yeah, and again, it uses feet and that, but a lot of people have switched over to squares if you're going to really care about the range. And
But then you also have to do converting the squares to feet and everything like that.
Yeah, which is fine by multiples of five. Like it's not that hard, but pick one, you know. Are you going to say, like, no, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. But also, you know, it kind of goes back to what Wayne mentioned earlier, is if they want to hold Pathfinder events where you might get set with completely different game masters from session to session, you need to have something that has a very standardized set number.
I'm not saying don't have it, but I think we see it, not to bring in another game, but I will, 13th Age, and we've only been playing it for a little bit. But the distances, they really just try to simplify it. You're either kind of close or you're a little bit far away.
Right.
Or you're completely out of range.
Yeah. And that's a personal thing. I like it much better.
Yeah, and just something like that. Instead of like, okay, I've got personal range, I've got touch. I understand the difference, but then I've got 25 feet, I got 100 feet, and then I've got,
10 I suppose feet. It all comes down to if you want to make the actual distance, the squares on the map, important. And if they are, then you need those kinds of measurements, either in squares or feet or what have you.
But you don't need as many.
No, I totally agree. You're right.
Yeah, if you could have close, medium, far, and that's about it.
Right.
Or something like that. Or personal, I mean, doesn't go beyond you. Close, and that could include touch. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. You know, you could break it down and reduce it to like four things or three things, and duration is only going to be three things. Is it going to be really quick? Is it going to be medium? Or is it going to be forever? Something like that.
Right.
And it's just a lot less to remember.
Mm. Yeah.
And you might actually be able to remember if you have a couple levels worth of spells. You might actually be able to remember that X has this range and this duration because you've only got a few options to choose from. So, and then you get into, we talk about damage and what is the damage? Is it going to be D6? Is it going to be how many D6s?
Right.
You know, or is it going to be D10? D4?
Are there modifiers in there? +2, plus your level, plus whatever.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in the game. So especially a lot going on. And actually this is a bit of an aside. The TV series Touch was on. And they're talking about, what do they call it? Platonic shapes.
Okay. You mean like the solids? Like the
platonic solids. Yes,
that
yes.
That dice
yeah.
are?
Oh, okay.
Yes. And the guy, he was a rabbi and he had them in front of them. And then she pulls out what is the equivalent of a D12. And he's like, where did you get that? Who gave you that?
Really?
Yeah, exactly. And he was holding something that actually did look like just a large size D12. And he's like, oh, it could be like the Zodiac or something like that. Yeah.
Like yeah. Or anything with 12 pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey,
or,
months.
Or it
yeah.
could be the damage of a bastard sword.
Right, yeah. right.
And now I'm looking up the damage of a bastard sword. Come on, people. Come on.
Is it a D12?
No, but I think this is win-win for me because it proves my point.
Right. I think that's
and
what
I And if I get it, then I'm like, come on. Yeah, I got it right.
Yeah. No, that's what I was going to say. No, you're absolutely right. The fact that there are all those little bits helps keep things fair, for lack of a better term, because...
D10.
Oh, we were close. Off by two. Ooh. Like, it helps keep things fair because you can refer to the rules when rules disputes arise. But on the other hand, there's a lot of moving parts and bits to remember, as you said. So if you're not familiar... Or if you haven't memorized those, then there's a lot of page flipping or link clicking on the SRD, and combat kind of slows down, which is just the nature of a rules-heavy game, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Great access, D12.
Oh, there you go.
You definitely need to write stuff down on a character sheet.
Yes.
And this gets into my point about the fiddly bits, is that you can't just write down... Here are my rogue abilities. I have this. Because then you have to write down what that means.
Right.
Or you'll be looking in the book to find out what it means.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And again, you know, you play it a long time. You get used to it. You memorize it. But then you got to imagine the Game Master. And we were complaining. Man, we were a couple of wimps. We were complaining about Blood and Smoke a little bit. We were complaining.
Yes.
You know, oh, look at all these conditions. Who's going to remember all of them? Even though they were pretty standardized. And now we got Pathfinder, and it's like, wow, who can remember all of this? Wow,
oh,
really?
Oh, man. I tell you, then, you know, you talk about all the different choices you have for the characters, because in this, it's the same with NPCs. NPCs are just characters. There's no shortened versions of the rules. So, man, each monster that I have has a page worth of statistics and rules,
right.
and that's if they don't have spells, you know? So, it was a lot to keep track of.
I remember... when I first opened 13th Age and looked at the monsters, I was like, wow, that's not a lot. But now that we're playing it, I'm like, I don't need any more.
Hmm, yeah.
That's all I need.
Hmm.
If I want to build somebody special, then I'll build somebody special. But just for somebody who's only going to be there for combat, I just need these five pieces of information.
Right.
I like having the big monster sheets because, you know, like I said, I enjoy making characters for Pathfinder, but at some point it does get to be too much. And just one more rule on the side that I wanted to mention, the chase rules for Pathfinder are horrible.
Oh, yes, yeah. We did try those out. Those are optional rules. Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, yeah. It was, exactly, an optional rule to the side. I found some reviews online before we actually ran the session that included the chase, and everybody online said, these are horrible, here's some alternates. So, but we decided we wanted to go by the book, and everyone was right. The rules are pretty horrible for chasing.
Well, okay, to set it up, from what I remember, it was there was kind of like a track.
on the board, and the PCs started in, you know, the first square, and the thing we were chasing started a number of squares ahead, like one or yes. two, or depending on, you know, how much of a head start it had.
Yes.
And then to move to the next square, kind of the next block or area, you had to make one of two, possibly more, skill checks. So one of the options I remember is you could either, you know, try and jump from this rooftop to the adjoining rooftop with a successful acrobatics check of a DC of 20 or something like that. I'm just making these numbers up. Or you could drop down to the streets and, you know, make a, not athletics, make a different check.
Acrobatics to run through a narrow alley or something
right,
like that.
Okay. And, when you set it up, Chris, you said, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you said, the book says I'm supposed to put this kind of Candyland-style board out. The players are supposed to be aware of what checks they need to make to do either of the options to move to the next square. Exactly. Is that how it went?
Yeah, basically it turns it into a board game. You show them the chart of their different options for basically each step along the board to the finish line. They have two or three options. And then each option has a different skill check and a different, DC for the skill.
Right.
And, it just like you said, the example was kind of go high over the rooftops and the skill checks involved in there, or go low between alleyways. And, it was a little unbalanced because they were chasing after a ghoul, which has a very good kind of acrobatics and climbing checks. Like that, so it was able to move better than the characters were, especially Wayne in a full suit of armor who just kept falling off a rooftop.
Well, I looked at that and I said, okay, that's what, you know, whoa, that's going to modify my DC check, and so, you know what, I just chose to run along the ground. But I guess my point was, did the book specifically say, lay this out to your players?
Yes.
Okay. Because I will agree, after that session where we had the chase, I'm like, that was very unsatisfying. And maybe I'm going to be a little bit unfair, but I don't think you really gave it a chance, Chris. Because I remember before the session, you said, I've been told that the standard Pathfinder chase rules are crap, and I have an alternative if you want to use them that people say is much better. Which do you want to pick? And we said, we're trying to play this game rules as written so we can give a review of it. Let's go with the standard chase rules. And while it was unsatisfying, I think it could have been dressed up with more description and, I don't know, treated a bit less mechanically. Because I remember it, you kind of said, and sorry I'm being harsh here, you could said, okay, well, you could jump to the rooftop by making a DC 20 check. I think that could have been spiced up by...
The rooftop looms before
well,
you.
Well, by narration.
Narrow alleyway kind of thing.
Because when you get down to it, everything we do in a role-playing game is mechanical, you know, and it's just however much flavor you put on top of it. So if we played again, and I don't know if we will, I would be willing to try those chase rules again, because not knowing what the alternative is, I don't think they're any more or less crap than other chase rules I have seen.
Yeah, you're right. I admit I approached it with quite a bit of cynicism. It seems that the chase rules were made, and this is not proven, of course, but the chase rules were made in order for Paizo to be able to sell these packs of cards that were like chase packs, depending on different kinds of areas and scene. So I went into it not looking very favorably upon it. So yeah, maybe.
And that's a little sneak peek. Preview of what to expect in part two of Campaign Confessions.
No. Yes. I mean,
of the crapping on the guy who spent all that time making the game.
No. It's far worse than that, actually.
The chase rules, I can definitely see it as a way to sell different packs, because it actually was confusing a little bit for me in that we were using a standardized thing, which was where did we start running? Did we start running in the cemetery? Or did we start running with buildings, but we ended up running through a marsh or something like that?
No, it started, it was all in buildings. It was wet because it had rained before.
No, but I think we passed through a terrain. So we started in one kind of terrain or setting, and the chase extended beyond something else, but we were still using this particular card, which was all like a rooftop chase.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the spaces so we moved to changed.
No, it was pretty much a rooftop chase. It was all like we could run from building to building, but our setting actually wasn't a series of buildings that could extend for a long chase. I think our setting was a few buildings.
Oh, the map we started on only had a few buildings, but the chase was supposed to take place across most of a town. So
I remember just when we finished the chase, mm-hmm. being a little bit confused where we were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because what it didn't correspond 100%. The great thing about these cards, both chase cards or these battle mats, is that they are more visual. The downside is they can then kind of take over and become the entirety of the setting.
Yeah. And we had unless a problem with one of the maps, huh?
All right. Well, we'll move on to intangibles and then we'll wrap up this part of the episode. What did you guys think of the PDF or the book? Some of us had the book, some of us had the PDF. But what'd you think?
Beautiful. Yeah, I love the artwork in it, and I love the presentation of the artwork. It's filled with lots and large, full-color paintings depicting these fantasy people and vistas. And yeah, I think I'm going to steal your line here, Lyle, looking at those pictures makes me want to play fantasy.
Yeah, it definitely does. Art-wise, I really like the book. Yeah, as you said, the illustrations are great. The only thing, I'm worked mostly from a hard copy of the book, which I was lucky enough to pick up secondhand, like right before we started playing for a reasonable price, I thought. The few times I tried to use the PDF, the full art on the pages, especially around like the borders, can make it a rather heavy PDF. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, not complaining here, but my phone couldn't handle it, or, you know, it was just kind of, sometimes pages would take a while to load. So I preferred using the book, and it's still just easier to flip pages. But mm-hmm.
Yeah, I only use the PDF for eye candy. When it actually came time to do the rules, I went straight to the SRD.
Right.
No, it's a gorgeous book. It's a big book, so it's a little bit intimidating.
Yes.
But yeah, just the art in there, like the scenes and the settings. Yeah, you could really see yourself playing the game. It even gives you ideas of what games you want to play. You know, I want to get to this point. I want to have this encounter. Yeah. It is gorgeous. Yeah.
Or in my case, I want to play this character, which is exactly what I did.
Yeah, they had some. The character pictures were pretty good. For those people that are concerned about gender or ethnic equality, they have
decent.
That. You know.
And for those who like cheesecake, it's there too.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, I mean, actually, I think for our 4E campaign back in the day, I stole some Pathfinder pictures to use in that. Because the art is great.
Yeah. So certainly can't fault that at all. I think the layout is nothing revolutionary. It is similar to Dungeons & Dragons.
See, simple two-column
setup.
Yep. Yeah, but also just like how the chapters are organized. I think it's almost identical to the Player's Handbook for 3.5. But I found that some things were not located
where they seemed to be needed.
Right. I think one thing, Shield Bash came up.
Right.
And we're trying to find where was Shield Bash in the book, and I believe it was with equipment.
Did we ever find it?
Did we? I think we had to look in the SRD to find it because, like, as a paladin,
we found Shield Bash feat, but I don't think we ever found the actual Shield Bash itself.
Yeah.
No, it's in equipment under shields.
Oh, okay.
So I guess we were the first people to think that, and maybe that's when you think about Shield Bash, most people go, hey, well, look where the shields are in the equipment. Mm. But to me, that seemed an odd place to put it. I found that, I mean, this is, wow, depending on where you want to start counting, this is several incarnations of the D&D system.
Right.
And there were still things I don't think were explained that clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of things, like, we already know or knew from playing 3.5, 3rd edition, or other D&D games, so that's hard to judge. But then we're like, oh, I got to build a magic item, and you know, I wasn't too used to building magic items. It's been years since I had.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the pricing of it. And I'm like, well, do I need to buy the master weapon and then pay for the magic item?
Because I remember you agonizing over that, yeah.
I mean, it says right here that the magic item is automatically a master class weapon, so that means that the cost is already factored in. And I actually have to go online to find the answer to that. And you're like, well, why don't you provide an example? If people are going to be building all these magic items, just give them a very simple breakdown of, okay, I bought a sword. I paid this for the master class. Then I paid this for the plus one. Then I paid this for the cold damage. So I thought that was a bit of a miss.
Yeah, especially as you said, Lyle, because this is, what, like the third or fourth incarnation kind of these rules, depending on where you want to start counting. So that means they've had all these opportunities to kind of see where things should be put.
So overall, what'd you think about the Pathfinder system?
Good, solid, with lots and lots and lots of information to go on. For myself, with a full-time job and a toddler, it's too much to handle. It's just too much information to remember and work with. So I think it's a very good game that I would probably take a pass on to run again.
I probably feel the same way, maybe for a different reason. I think there is a lot to remember. And part of the reason I like rules light game is because it allows me, whether I'm a player or a GM, it allows me to get to a position of familiarity with the rules quicker than with rules heavy games such as Pathfinder. I didn't hate the game. I probably
which is high praise for Wayne.
Yeah, exactly. It's as high as you're going to get. I don't think I would want to play it again.
I would like to play it again, and I'd like to play it again with the lessons learned for myself. I don't think I built the best character. I was going for two-weapon fighting with my rogue. That was a mistake. I had spells, but I didn't do the cards. That was a mistake, and that's on me. I think this is the type of game, and this is something that we don't do. We actually play multiple systems.
Right.
And some systems I think we've really got a handle on, such as World of Darkness. We played it enough in different settings that we feel fairly comfortable with the rules. But some games we've played once or twice. Pathfinder is the type of game that if you play this and make this your primary game or your exclusive game, I think it will be very, very rewarding because it'll become faster and faster and faster, and the options are just going to reward you for committing to this one game.
Right.
And then as Wayne said earlier, you can go to gaming conventions, you can go to gaming stores and sit in, and people are going to play by pretty standard rules. The more rules means the easier it is for somebody to arbitrate and make rulings without people complaining too much. Waha, people are still going to complain. So that's what I would do. I think with Pathfinder, if I were going to play it on a regular basis, I would play it on a regular basis. Because I would need to just to get up, become more familiar with it.
Yeah,
right.
Pretty much the same way I feel. If I had more time to invest in it, this would be a great game to play.
Yeah. So, make it your only fantasy game. But right now we have other games that we're also playing that are fantasy. So I don't know if we would return to it and then make this the exclusive fantasy game. But they support it pretty well.
Yeah, definitely do.
You're never going to run out of stuff.
Yeah, and some cases, like you can be cynical, such as Chris with the chase rules, because it seems like a way to sell the cards. And in other cases, you're like, no, I really appreciate having a monster manual. Or bestiary 5 or 6. That's great. Which giants will be in this one?
More bestiaries. All right, cool. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us again on Knight of Red Hands. You can check us out online at www.idledredhands.com at redhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, plus one us on G+. I think I got that right. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. You can also follow us on our forums, which are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. And are located at idleredhands.com/forums. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week with a continuation of the campaign confessions. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Comes full circle, huh?
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know. Is it a circle? Anyway.
Well, I guess if this would be the last game he ever ran.
Right, right.
So we'll decide at the end of this.
Wait, what are you guys saying?
Hey, we'll save that for part two.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.